for supporting the Fable and Folly Network. Here's another show we know you'll love.
Greetings, I'm Bernard.
And I'm Magenta. You might know us from such hit podcasts as Madame Magenta, Sonus Mystica.
Horror Anthology Magenta Presents.
Or Season 3 of Mockery Manor.
We're everywhere.
And we're spreading faster than an STD in an old folks' home, because now we have a brand new podcast. Wham!
Wham! It's a fun acronym that stands for We Have a Movie.
Oh, it's not just an acronym, Bernard.
It's not?
It's a chat podcast where we invent smash hit Hollywood movies based on popular toys.
If you like the Barbie movie and you want to see similar treatments of your favourite childhood toys, I'll wager you'll like Wham! With episodes on Polly Pocket, Rubik's Cube, Game Boy, Strawberry Shortcake,
Furby, Connect Four, and lots of other nostalgia bait. But it's not just for adults who still like toys. It's a podcast for anyone who loves Hollywood tropes and comedy.
And quantum mechanics.
And BDSM.
Wham! Has something for everyone, but is still specifically about movies.
That's Wham! W-H-A-M. You know, like when Batman punches someone.
Yes.
Adam West. That Batman.
Exactly.
Not the Christopher Nolan one.
No.
Download it anywhere you listen to podcasts. That's what the world needs, another movie podcast.
Was that clear? Maybe I shouldn't have mentioned quantum mechanics.
Hi, I'm Yusuf Dahl, and when I was 18, I was convicted of selling drugs. For the past 3 years, I've had difficulty finding housing because it is legal in the United States to discriminate against individuals that have a past drug distribution conviction on their record for life. It doesn't matter if it was a hard drug like heroin or a drug that's now legal or partially legal in many states across the country, like marijuana. The Thurman Amendment was introduced to the Fair Housing Act in 1988 by segregationist Strom Thurmond, and it's since been used to deny housing to all people. But because people of color are disproportionately jailed for drug charges, we are affected more. My goal is to overturn this amendment to start an end to housing discrimination that unfairly targets people of color. If you would like to join this movement, please visit ThurmanAmendment.org to learn more.
A message from the Fable and Folly Network.
This is Yanni, and I am the producer, writer, director, and editor of Harlem Queen. We are very busy recording, editing, and sound designing our latest episodes, which will be available in May. In the meantime, I thought you may enjoy another series,
The Griots, Harlem and Moscow.
Tells the incredible and true story of icons of the Harlem Renaissance who traveled to Russia in 1932 to make a Russian propaganda film. I had the opportunity to speak with the writer of the series, Ali Mims. We had a good time chatting up this historical adventure and spoke a little about researching and writing historical fiction. I hope you enjoy our chat. If you have any questions, please do not hesitate to reach out. On Instagram, I'm Yanni Writes Audio. That's Y-H-A-N-E dot writes, W-R-I-T-E-S dot audio. Or my newsletter is harlemqueen.substack.com, or on Facebook, I'm Harlem Queen Audio Drama. Thank you.
Okay.
Tell me how to say your name one more time.
Yanni, like Johnny, but with a Y.
Got it.
Yeah. And you're Allie.
Yes. Just okay. Allie. Just spelled okay. A little weird.
No, I know. I hear you. I grew up with an interesting spelling.
Yeah. You understand.
Yeah, absolutely. So at this point, I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. I don't know how you get Yvonne out of Yanni, but okay, I'll respond to it. You know, that's when I was a kid. But now I'm impressed because it seems like people are much more familiar with seeing quote unquote foreign, or maybe not foreign, but diverse names.
Yes.
So
I agree.
I'm very impressed with how people can just read it now, and mm-hmm. I'm just impressed by that. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, we're going to dive right in. I tend to get long-winded, especially when it comes to history. I'm so excited about learning about this story. And So I would love for you, it's just three phases. Mm-hmm. Love for you to tell us about the audio drama, what it is, and tell us a little about Dorothy West. And then I would love to dive into your research process, the history.
Okay.
So whenever you're ready.
Okay, sure. Dorothy West was a member of the Harlem Renaissance, as we know it, also known as the New Negro Movement. She was one of the youngest people who were interested in this literary movement. She started off writing short stories and eventually gained traction with her novels. Her most well-known one is probably The Wedding, which was turned into a miniseries by Oprah. And also The Living is Easy is her other very popular novel. And I came across her while studying this event in history that this audio series is based on. In 1932, a group of 22 Harlem Renaissance artists, intellectuals, there were newspaper writers, poets, actors, every type of person that you would find in Harlem. They all traveled to Moscow in order to make a communist propaganda film that was actually sponsored by the Soviet government. And this was a huge deal. It was front page news and various newspapers whenever they left. It was a big deal, both in film and just in the Black community and Black art in general, because they were being paid so handsomely. But obviously, there was some risk involved. First of all, just traveling to the other side of the world, but also going to the Soviet Union at a time where it's a very new country. I believe it's in its first 10 years or so of its formation. Not a lot is known about that part of the world. We're coming up on World War II, almost the rise of Hitler. So the international, there's also a lot happening with Japan and the fascism there. And so things are very, it's like a hotbed, you know, it's the waters are about to boil over. And this movie, the original intent was to actually start a class revolution in America in the same way that it happened in Russia before the Soviet Union. Also on this trip was Langston Hughes, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of, also appears in your audio series, and Louise Thompson Patterson, who was an organizer and political activist, as well as professor at the time. There was also Henry Lee Moon, who went on to gain prominence through his reporting, and Ted Poston as well. They were there covering the trip for the Amsterdam News. And all of this, so the audio series that I wrote, Harlem and Moscow, it's this trip told by the point of view of Dorothy West. As I said, she was the youngest one of the group. She was an actor at the time. She had just finished a show that actually toured to France. So this was not her first time traveling for the arts, but definitely the farthest away from home she had ever been. So she was an actress. She had a short story that had gained a lot of notoriety when she was very young. And so that was sort of her entry into this world. And she was also interested in, of course, the politics. We can't ignore that. The Communist Party was a huge factor in this trip. Although not everyone on the trip would have identified as a communist. I believe only one of them had a Communist Party card at the time. I think it's safe to say that they were at least communist curious, I like to call them. They at least wanted to see what the Soviet Union had going on that made it so great. And so they all embarked on this trip. It only lasted a few months for some. For some, they ended up staying a year or two. And at least one person on the trip stayed in the Soviet Union until his death. He ended up starting a life there. So it was very, very attractive for very many reasons.
I love it. Thank you so much for the breakdown. I hate when people put me on the spot like this, but I'm going to put you on a spot and ask, in my limited research to do Harlem Queen, County Cullen came up as someone who attended. Was he in this group of folks?
So he was not. He was invited, but he turned them down, not unkindly. He was not as interested in the Communist Party. He didn't really believe that this trip would happen or that it would be a good idea. It was him. Zora Neale Hurston also didn't want to go, but was against the trip. And Alan Locke as well was very against the trip. He actually bought a ticket on the same boat as them to Germany. And he rowed the boat all the way across the Atlantic with the hopes of convincing at least one person to come back home with him and not go to the Soviet Union. That's how against the trip he was.
Wow.
So not everyone was, and it was a risk. You know, they were putting their trust in the Soviet government, in this, the Meshrepalm production company, which is technically like a German-Russian company, but, you know, basically funded by the Soviets and by the Communist Party. And so some people on the trip, like Louise Thompson Patterson, were much more involved in the party, much more vocally pro-communist. Mm-hmm. And other people were, like I said, more skeptical, more critical, but decided to go anyway, because at the end of the day, it was a free trip. Well, they had to pay their way across, but they were reimbursed and then they were paid a stipend. They were paid room and board. I mean, they were making more money on this trip than they were when they were on Broadway in America.
Sure.
So there were a lot of reasons why people went, despite the fact that they were not communists. But County Cullen was one that was pretty vocally against the trip and thought it was a little crazy for people to agree to it.
Right. No. Interesting. Interesting. I love that. I did not know that. I did not know that Dorothy West was an actress.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
That's incredible.
Mm-hmm. She was in Porgy, which, as far as I can tell, was a play version of Porgy and Bess.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember if it was on Broadway. I think it was on Broadway. And then it actually toured to France. So, yeah, she was a budding actress. And, you know, I think that was a big reason why so many people went as well, because they didn't have to audition. They didn't have to do anything. Basically, the Soviets were just like, oh, we just need like 20 or 30 Negroes, but that'll be good.
Yeah.
And so they just showed up. And so some of them, only a few of them, like five or six of them, were actually actors. The other 15 were not.
Wow. Interesting. I assume this is pre-Paul Robeson era. I understand he traveled there also.
I believe he went right after. And by right after, I mean like a year or two. It was very close.
Mm-hmm.
He traveled there. Also, Claude McKay traveled there a few years prior. He had gone and he did not have great things to say about the Soviet Union and how he was treated there, which is, I think, why some people in this group who were invited did not go, because they were like, look, we just heard from Claude. He got back, you know, in 1929 and he did not have a great time.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think you should go. We don't think it'll look very good. That was another fear was, well, how, if this doesn't work out, how is it going to reflect on the race back in America?
Sure. Wow. So what was the like goal of this film? Like, who was going to act in it? Who's going to, can you break that down a little bit for us?
Sure. Well, film is still very new at this point. And I think it was seen as being very powerful. I still think film is very powerful, but obviously it's also entertainment a lot of the times, especially in America. But at this time, Russia and then the Soviet Union are known for making pretty radical films that have very political stories and plots, and also like calls to action at the end of their films.
Mm-hmm.
And so this quite literally was meant to inspire a revolution in America. They wanted to show the true plight of the Negro worker, especially in the South. And so they were going to film in Odessa, which is like in the South of the Soviet Union. And it's where they grow their cotton. And so they were literally shooting in like a cotton field. And they wanted what they called, quote unquote, authentic Negroes to show what it's like to be like this laborer, this working class. And unfortunately, well, I don't want to say unfortunately, but the Soviets were sort of smacked in the face with that when they realized, oh, like everyone we've invited they're kind of posh. They're academics, they're pencil pushers, you know, like only one of them really identified themselves as the working class. It was a man who used to work on, I believe, a sugar colony in the Caribbean. Everyone else was like, I'm an academic, I'm a reporter, I'm an artist, you know. And I would, you know, in today's context, put them in the working class because none of these people were extremely wealthy. Dorothy West was on the upper end of upper middle class, but even her, you know, all of these people are one, sometimes two generations away from slavery. And so even to be wealthy within that context is a very precarious position to be in. And so, but they didn't see themselves as working class in the way that the Soviets viewed Southern workers specifically. None of them had worked in a steel mill or worked in the field in that way. And so there was sort of this expectation by the Soviets of, oh, well, you'll just all come and you'll just naturally be able to portray this. And when that wasn't the case, they were quite disappointed in who they had invited. And one of my favorite anecdotes from the story is that they, the script, Langston Hughes has been very open about the fact that the script is not good. He doesn't think it's a good script, that he thinks they have to rewrite the whole thing by the time they get there. And so they say, okay, we'll get rid of the script, but we're going to keep the spirituals in there. They have a lot of songs in there because they knew that, you know, this is a big part of Black culture is like these spirituals. But the problem is most of these people are not religious. They don't know these spirituals. And so the Soviets just assumed, oh, you know this one. Go ahead, sing it. And like two people were able to sing out of the 20. And it's just these stereotypes really of like, well, we just assumed you all could sing. We assumed you could dance. We assumed you all have worked on a farm in a field somewhere in some capacity. And that just was not true for the majority of the people on the trip.
Wow, that is hilarious. That's the story. I mean, did you incorporate some of that in the story? I'm sure.
Yes. Okay. There is an episode. I don't want to give too much away, but yes, there is one person who's very religious, and she is able to sort of carry the team for that episode. Like, but she's not shy about the fact that they should all be ashamed that they don't know these important spiritual songs.
Sure. Oh my gosh. That is so, I mean, now I have so many layers of questions that I'll remember later, but not right now, but that's fascinating. Do you know where we would be able to see this film? Like, does it exist or was it ever made?
Well, spoiler alert, I guess, but this is 100-year-old history, so you can find this online anywhere. But if you don't want to know the ending, stop listening. But the film does not end up getting made. The Soviets keep pushing back production until they finally say, well, you know, it's going to be too cold. We're going to postpone it. That's what they said. They said it wasn't canceled. It was postponed. So what ended up happening is they actually did make a short animation that was supposed to sort of serve as the same thing. I think it's only 5 minutes and it is on YouTube. If you Google, I believe the title, it was the same title that the film was supposed to be, Black and White. It's, I think you just say like Black and White 1930s Soviet animation. And it's very interesting because even the way they draw Black Americans is very stereotypical. You know, it's stylized, but it's, there are some kind of disturbing images in it. And like the way they view race and like revolution is very, very black and white. You know, it's very like, well, all you have to do is just stand up for yourself and then you'll have rights. And it's like, well, we've tried that.
Right.
So it's very interesting. You kind of get a glimpse into like how they view the quote unquote race problem in America through this little 5 minute animation.
Wow. Fascinating. I love it. So my next question was, I have a notepad and I already forgot what it was. Something about the film, but I'll come back to it. So please tell us a little bit about, oh, I know what my question was. I'll edit that out. So break down the series for us. How many episodes? How long is each episode? And all of that good stuff.
Harlem in Moscow is 6 episodes long. Each episode is around 20 minutes, between 20 and 25 minutes. And we release 2 episodes every Monday, starting with this last Monday. So the next 2 weeks, we'll have 2 episodes per Monday. We also have a companion podcast that will be released as well. It's called Harlem in Moscow, Red Flags. And I'm really excited about these episodes because they're basically interviews with a great host. Every time it's a different host. Me and then some sort of academic in the field. And so we get to really dig deeper into like the history, the politics, the culture, and really hear from, you know, I do research as a writer. You understand a lot of times it can be very pinpoint. Like there are some of these people's lives who like, yes, I have their biography, but I read two chapters, you know, mm-hmm. and obviously there are 30 chapters. And so mm-hmm. bringing in someone who has written a book like Tanisha C. Ford, she wrote Our Secret Society, which is all about Molly Moon, who does not appear in my series, but she's mentioned a few times. And so okay. to talk to someone like that, who has followed this woman from birth to death, and while I have only really known her for this 12-month period, it's really fascinating to hear their point of view of someone who has really studied it for years.
Yes. Oh, wow. That's one. I mean, hindsight is 2020. I wish I had done more of that or any of it at all when I did Harlem Queen one, because I'm realizing that things that I assumed people would know, mm-hmm. they don't know. It's okay. I mean, yeah, I didn't know. I never heard of Stephanie St. Clair like 6 years yeah. ago until I made it. Or I didn't, like you just told me, like about, like I did not know Dorothy West was an actress. You know, I know who, and the only book I love, well, I shouldn't say I like of hers, but I'm most familiar with is The Wedding, like you said.
Yes, same. Yeah. No, same here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I may take up, as they say, take a page from your book and follow up and do that with Harlem Queen. yes. So I'm a writer. You're a writer. I'm very fascinated about, like you were saying, the research process and the writing process. So first, let's talk about research. Like, I mean, I know it's such an open question. I, like you mentioned, I love to read books. I love to read newspapers. Like in Amsterdam News, I'm going to go look up that, these articles about this trip in the Amsterdam News. I love the Amsterdam News for the language and the headlines and anyway.
Yes,
And I love other podcasts and other people, believe it or not. All of a sudden, everyone I know, their neighbor was a numbers runner, or their aunt was, a numbers played the number. I mean, all of a sudden, everyone did this. So I shouldn't say everyone, but even like a couple of people in my church, in my hometown, I did not know. But my sister's like, oh, yeah, that's what blah, blah. I'm like, oh, really? Anyway, but so I take it for, I listen to music. I watch movies. I listen to podcasts. I read magazine articles. People send me stuff. I talk to people. Please break down your research process.
I first got to know this story in class, actually. So that was a great break. A way to break into this story for me. A class taught by Dr. Jennifer Wilson at Columbia. I believe it was a Barnard class, but I was crashing it as a Columbia student. And the whole semester was just about this one trip. And we dove a little bit into like Claude McKay's trip, Paul Robeson's trip, but for like 90% of the semester, it was just this group who went on this trip. So the first time I read something about it, it was in Langston Hughes's memoir, I Wonder As I Wander, which he published, I believe, a year or two after this trip. So we read the section on that. And then I also was introduced to the archive for the first time through Louise Thompson Patterson's archive, which is at Emory. And thanks to, well, the fact that I was involved with this institution, but also thanks to the pandemic, many archives are now digitized, and that is great because you can just request it online.
Yes.
And so that's where I started, was with her archive. I read through the hundreds of pages in that. And that's when this story was first born. I actually had to do an assignment for her class. It was supposed to be a 10-page essay. And I was like, well, you know, I'm a playwriting student. What if I write a 10-page scene? And she was like, that's incredible. Yes, please do that. I think she was just excited not to read another essay. and from there, I started writing a different script, which is not quite this one. It was much more from Langston Hughes's point of view. Mm-hmm. And then whenever I hooked up with the Griot, I pitched the story sort of in general. But because of the nature of the project, I wanted to start from scratch. And so from there, I knew that I wanted to go from someone else's point of view than Langston Hughes, which is kind of the majority of the narratives you hear is Langston Hughes, sometimes Louise Thompson Patterson, and which were like the two most prominent people on the trip. So it makes sense. But I looked up who else on the trip had an archive. Essentially, I became obsessed with the archive. So I'm like, who has an archive that I can like sift through? And it came down to Loren Miller. I hope I'm saying that correctly. It might be Loren Miller. He went on to be a civil rights lawyer. And Dorothy West, they both had archives that were digitized and had some activity during this time period. And I basically skimmed through both of those archives and decided on Dorothy West because she had, you know, tens of letters back and forth between her and her mom while she was in Moscow. And it was so incredible to read, like the little things, you know, like one of her first letters back, she's like, I forgot my hot comb and I don't know if I'll be able to buy something like that overseas. Like it was just so interesting. And like hearing little like gossip and also realizing like she's talking to her mom. So she's probably leaving certain things, you know, she's being a little vague on certain days. And so those letters were really the birth of this, this point of view of the story. And that's where I got the majority of my information from, was the letters that she was writing home pretty religiously to her mother. It was so interesting. It was so nice. And then on top of that, that was definitely my biggest source. But then I also read a section of Dorothy West's biography, Dorothy West's Paradise, and Louise Thompson Patterson's biography, A Life, A Life of Struggle for Justice. And then, of course, like I said, Langston Hughes's memoir. And like I mentioned earlier, it was a lot of picking and choosing. I don't want people to think I read like five books cover to cover. It's very much like a lot of these people quite literally have a Moscow chapter in their biographies. And so I focused on their early life and what they had to say about this trip to Moscow. And that's really where the story was born from. It was these very personal letters. And then the parts of the letters that were kind of vague or where she was hinting at things, that's when I went into these other biographies, these other memoirs and sources who would sort of fill in the blanks, especially Louise Thompson Patterson. Her biography reads like a tell-all. I mean, these people, Langston Hughes and Dorothy West, were a little more reserved, a little more leaving people's names out, a little more, oh, this happened, but we're not going to talk about it. Louise Thompson's biography is just, you know, she's naming names. She's like, it was this person. They were dating this person. They cheated with this person. It is very illuminative. And so I used a lot of her biography to sort of fill in the pieces that I felt might be missing from Dorothy West's letters home.
Nice.
And also for like the language, I think I kind of struggled with that at the beginning. And I love your podcast. I haven't listened to the whole thing, but it did come up whenever I was looking up. I was like, I need sources of like, how do they speak back then? And so I actually listened to a couple episodes of your podcast because it was really the only thing that came up about like Harlem in the 1930s. So I was like, I guess I got to give this one a listen. And I also watched a lot of Oscar Michaud's films.
Same.
I think that really helped with the language because the first draft or two of the script, it was really like just modern language. And so after watching a bunch of his films, I would just take phrases and catchphrases and little words and the way they would say things. And then on top of that, obviously the actors did such a great job bringing it to life to where some things that might seem a little modern on the page, once you say them in a certain way, it really sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting. For me, it was trying to find the language was important to me. That's why I used the newspapers, I think. And also, I'm not ashamed to say, I'm proud to say I'm a little older than you. So my mother was closer to that generation, like the 30s and whatnot. So she and all the women, and I'm very fortunate to have grown up someplace that all the people were, you know, I'm Black, all old Black people from the South. So so I used a lot of things that they picked up, not picked up, I'm sorry, that they would say, like my dad loved to use the term, pull your coat. And I love that term, pull your coat, even though it's not from the 1920s, I don't think. But anyway, so The point that I'm, see, I'm long-winded.
No.
The point I'm making is that one thing that I thought was important. Thank you so much for listening to my show, by the way. And I'm so glad it was a source for your research. I'm
Absolutely.
So glad for that. And one thing that I understood, how I understood it, was that that was a time when Black people, or African American, or we didn't call ourselves that, Negroes, were trying to distinguish themselves from being people, children of slaves,
yep.
slaves, you know, mm-hmm. property, people, and, you know, and awful things. You know, we I don't Absolutely. Need to go into all of that. So for me, I really wanted the characters to have a fake sophistication. I mean, I see
yes,
it as fake.
Yes.
Like that mid-Atlantic
Absolutely.
Accent is huge to me. I mean, I grew up with that. I mean, people in my hometown, these are African Americans that spoke with a mid-Atlantic accent. I mean, when I was a child, people were like, why does she talk British? Seriously, I mean, I was just trying to elocute, you know?
Yeah.
So that was very important to me, bringing that across, because, right there, that's a big statement of the history, where we were in this, and that at that point in this country, and where we... we're trying to break from and move forward into. So, mm-hmm. yeah, that's finding the language. I'm sorry.
No, that's what the new Negro movement was all about. Was
yeah.
And I agree. There is a bit of fakeness to it, because it is like, I'm not like those other Black folks. And it's like, but you are. Those are your parents. Like,
yes.
obviously, we all came from the South at some point. Like,
yes.
You know, whether you're one or five generations away, it's this sense of shame that. You know, that's the only way that America sees Black folks. Well, I don't want to be seen that way. Like you said,
right.
there's so many harmful stereotypes. There's also such rich culture from the South.
Yes.
I mean, that's really the mecca of Black culture. And so people like Langston Hughes, which, you know, some people have thoughts about how he did this, but, you know, trying to elevate, you know, the Negro dialect, or at least,
right.
you know, show it to a wider audience of like,
right.
yes, this is the way my parents speak. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I agree. The people, especially the people on this trip, they don't want to sound like that. They don't want to talk like that.
No.
They're trained actors. They're,
yes.
they're literary people. They have graduate degrees. So they
Indeed.
All do kind of put on airs in that way, for sure.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's wonderful. I mean, back, and I'll leave it alone, but like, that's mm-hmm. why in episode, I think one of Harlem Queen, I wanted to put Paul Lawrence Dunbar in there, because when I was a kid, that was fun. Paul Lawrence Dunbar's poetry was really fun for me. I mean, Paul Lawrence Dunbar, what, he's like 1880s, 1890s, I'm not sure. But and I was like, wow, this is a Black person speaking Black, you know, quote unquote Black. And it was just... I remember Jump Back, Baby, Jump Back was this poem my sister used. And I just thought it was like a patty
yes.
cake game.
Rhythm,
and I thought
yeah.
so affirmed in that. I was like, oh, well, this is okay. We can. And then, of course, Zora Neale Hurston, when I learned about her when I was a teenager, I wanted to be a Zora Neale Hurston. I wanted mm-hmm. to celebrate the way we, you know, the whole thing. And that's something you and I and Zora have in common. We all went to Columbia. Like I'm a Columbia scholar.
So did West.
Oh my gosh, I did not know that.
Yeah, I think she just took some classes. I don't know that her degree is from there, but yeah, she mm-hmm. also went to Columbia.
Wow. I mean, yeah. I'm not getting a degree from there. I'm what they call a community scholar.
Okay,
but
cool.
Close enough.
Dorothy West, I think. Yeah.
Yes.
There you go.
Oh my gosh, I have
and
to write
Langston
that.
Langston Hughes also went, although he
yes.
dropped out after
yeah.
a year.
Yes, I wonder why. Yes, I
yeah.
know that because he went to not Lincoln. Did he go to Lincoln or Cheney?
He ended up going to Lincoln later
Lincoln.
On.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm writing that down.
Yes. It's so I mean, I was so shocked. Like I said, I took this class at Columbia and I had no idea that all of
yeah.
these people had gone through in one way or another. You know, I'm not
mm-hmm.
sure that all of them hold a degree from there, but they took
mm-hmm.
classes there or at Barnard. I think Zora Neale Hurston was the first Black student at Barnard.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I was really shocked, you know, because this stuff just isn't really taught, you know, and we're kind of taught that those Black folks are anomalies who just were sort of born this way. And so to learn that, like, no, they studied, like, they studied, like, literature and, you know, art making. I was kind of like, oh, so they weren't just born geniuses.
Yeah.
Like we're kind of led to believe, like, went to Ivy Leagues.
Yeah. No, absolutely. That's so important for a big realization to me. And I just think it's so funny. Like, I mean, I can, if I didn't laugh, I would cry. But I just think it's so hilarious how the Russians assume, I mean, I shouldn't say Russians, like, I don't want to put all Russians in one pot. Totally. But these people for this program assumed that, oh, yeah, you're Negro, so you can do. I mean, honestly, until this research for my show, I would not have thought any other either. You know what I mean? I would not have thought that there would have been a whole generation of Black people who traveled to Europe, studied there, got ideas, brought them back here and integrated them. And people picked up, received them, internalized them and created poetry, music, art, blah, 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 whatever, politics, philosophy. I mean, it was just, I feel for the people who found it, but I can relate to it because I probably would have, unfortunately, done the same thing.
I mean, we're kind of led to believe that. Absolutely. I feel I've been guilty of the same thing. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. There's just so much to learn, to know. I mean, it isn't like 1932 is just in a bottle. There were people who were doing things, everything, good things, bad. Anyway, don't get me on about history. I'm just learning so many wonderful things. And it's like a treasure chest, honestly, to me. So if you could talk a little, and thank you so much. You're handling these questions so well. So you're answering everything that's in my mind. I appreciate you. So talk to me about the process of writing it. So you have to write in audio only, which I try to explain to people is not the same as writing a TV pilot or a film. Like, you have to think about your locations and where the sounds are and where, you know, I like to make them organic anyway. But so please talk a little about your process of writing these scripts.
It was difficult. I will say it was a challenge for me. I've mostly only written for the stage. I was trained in playwriting. And so when I first wrote it, I definitely wrote it more like a play. Like, I knew in the back of my mind it was going to be an audio drama, but it was much more like a play. And I definitely got some repetitive notes from producers saying, you know, oh, you need to have more of the setting in there. You need to be addressing people by their names more. We need an introduction because it, you know, we're not sure where we are. And it was a challenge for me to try to imagine, like, how much is too much? And I think if I could go back, I would recommend myself and anyone who's writing for audio to add even more audio cues than you think you need.
Yeah.
Because it'll come to the day of and you'll realize, oh, no one says like where we are. No one says who this is. People are just entering and exiting. And because I'm so immersed in the story and because I have live actors in front of me, I'm thinking, oh, this is all clear as day. And after we recorded, the producers were like, we're still, you know, we still need more audio cues. And in my mind, I'm like, this is too much, you know, but it's really hard for me to imagine it as someone who has no idea. Like you said, so many people have no idea who most of these people are. I didn't know who most of these people are until I started my research. And so I think I really should have thought about that a little more. Like, what, how would you tell this story to someone who has only ever heard of Langston Hughes and the Harlem Renaissance? And that's it.
Yeah.
How, like, start there. So it definitely took, I think it was like 7 or 8 drafts. And so many of those drafts were just like, add clues, clues for the listener. And even the day of recording, I was there for one day of recording, one of the days that I wasn't, but the day of recording, we're changing lines like on the fly.
Sure.
I'm like, actually, that doesn't sound right. Actually, you said that too many times. wait, this phrase exists in 1932. Let's Google it really quick.
Right, exactly.
Like the phrase comfort zone, which sounds so modern, but it's actually existed back then. And I was like, should we take it out? Because it sounds modern.
You know?
It's I hear existed.
You. Exactly. I mean, I was worried about using the term woke. So Stephanie St. Clair used that term. Yes, I know.
Right?
And I was like,
stuff like that.
Exactly.
Absolutely. I mean, even just saying something like having a boyfriend or a girlfriend, like obviously they use that language, but it just sounds so like modern teen now that I'm like, okay, let's find a different, let's call him a sweetheart, you know, because that just sounds more 1930s. Right. So although it was a huge learning experience. And I'm forever grateful to the Griot because I am so aware that they could have just canned it, you know, at any time. You know, it was I mean, I don't know the budget, but I know that they spent money on it, you know, and that, you know, audio production takes time, takes so many different people. I'm so impressed that you do so much on your own because I wrote it and then I kind of was just like, well, you know, my job here is done. You know, I wrote copy for like other things here and there, but for the most part, I was finishing my thesis and I was just kind of like, hey, I'm unavailable unless you need something written. I can do that, but I can't be around for like the audio production of it all. Sure. You know, I didn't really have a hand in that at all, which was really also very strange coming from the world of theater where usually the playwright is there every rehearsal, every performance, you know, taking notes and stuff. And so it was a learning experience for me. I think it was also a learning experience for the Griot because this was their first like dramatic audio series. Like they have a bunch of podcasts, a bunch of award-winning podcasts, but most of them are news, interview, entertainment. Those sorts of things. A lot of like talking heads, a lot of great hosts, you know, interviewing awesome people. So this was their first narrative piece. And so I think it was a big learning experience for them as well, because they're like, oh, you can't just kind of sit down and do it. There has to be a whole bunch of pre-work and a whole bunch of post-work that we're not usually doing on our like docu-series type of podcast. So I'm really grateful that they really took a chance on me. And especially like never having written an audio series, I was still a student at the time that they hired me. And I really lucked out in that they followed it through to the end. I mean, I'm still like sort of in shock that it got released. So yes, I'm very excited. I'm very grateful to them.
That's wonderful. Congratulations. That's so exciting.
Thank you so much.
Quick question. Did you all have a narrator in your story?
So this is so the format that I originally wrote it in is Dorothy West is telling the story to her mother. She's returned home and her mom is like, what happened? Tell me about Langston Hughes, yada, yada, yada. And so she's kind of the narrator throughout. But that was one of the notes that we got after we had recorded was, I think we need some sort of narrator. He needs to do recaps. He needs to do like next time on Harlem and Moscow. He needs to just sort of give an intro at the very beginning of the series to sort of say, hey, this is what we're doing. This is the time period, this and that. So that was actually added after the fact. And it was also strange because it kind of, you know, it's just such a different format than stage or film where you kind of want the mystery. You don't want people to exactly know what's going on.
Right.
And so it was a little bit of a hurdle for me to get used to having another narrator that wasn't like in the story. You know,
this
is very much like, mom, I want to tell you this story. First, we were on the train, then we were here, then we were there.
Right.
And so to have sort of an omniscient narrator saying, welcome to Harlem and Moscow. This is episode one. I was like, oh, this is weird. I do think I think it works. And I think that's pretty normal, I would say, for audio series, right? To have narrators. Yeah. I think I definitely found that through like listening to different types and everything. But yeah, we have a narrator. I don't know if he ever had a name, but I do remember when they asked me to write copy for him, they were like, ooh, make him a little sassy, make him like a little gossipy. And so I was like, okay, I don't know who this is, but sure.
Yeah. No, I asked because so when I started writing, it was frowned upon to have a narrator, right? And I think now that I look at it, think about it, I think it's just because people did not know how to teach how to incorporate a narrator effectively. Yeah. So people were just lazy and were like, okay, forget the narrator. So in my mind, I took that, like, don't use a narrator. Don't bother. So I never used a narrator, but now I wish I had. I mean, in my fourth season, I have Stephanie telling her story. So she's like the narrator, but I wish I had. I used a, there's a character, oh God, Lloyd Calvin or Calvin Lloyd. I can't remember which order his name is ever, but he was actually a newscaster in the 1920s. And I'm sorry.
No, I was about to say, like, I do remember there being sort of a narrator, but yes, right. Yeah. He was like giving the newscast in every episode. Right.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and I thought I was going to have to make up someone because I did not know there a Black person like that existed. And I found him and I was like, oh my gosh, this is a real person. It was like, I was so happy. And then of course, if you ever have any doubts about Black people being someplace, they were there. Yes. I mean, absolutely. And now my thing is, give me 5 minutes and Google and I will find them for you.
Yes. I love that.
which is very off tangent, but I wanted to incorporate some of the relationship or travels that some of these people had in my story in Harlem Queen, but the narrative just didn't open up for it. But because you probably know this, but Pushkin, the Russian writer, yes. They used to give out a Pushkin award because his ancestor or father or grandfather was African.
Yes.
And I thought that was so, I was like, I got to put that in. I mean, there's so many things that you read about and you're like, oh, I got to put that in. But now is the fourth season. And now I'm finally getting into putting things in that I wanted to put in like three seasons ago, which I guess is a fun question. Are there things that you wish you could have put in, but you just couldn't fit in there?
Oh, that's a good question. But yes and no. I feel like there's like a good balance, but yes, there was just so many little things. I think one thing is the size of the group. There was 22 people on this group, on this trip. And yeah, I think we hear from like six of them, if that. Mm-hmm. I think it's five. And so I do, like, there were people on the trip that I found so interesting, like Lauren Miller, that I wanted to dive more into of like, their origin story, essentially, because some of these people we don't really hear about in history until like the 50s or 60s when the civil rights movement really kicks off. Mm-hmm. So I wish I could have like given all of them a little shout out, you know, mm-hmm. and just said, oh, this person's here too. This person's here too. Mm-hmm. And also the Soviet side of it. I'm happy with how we focused on Dorothy West's relationships, but I wish like there was a little more, and this would have taken more research on my part as well, is like there was so much like culture change happening in the Soviet Union. Not always a good thing, but interesting, mm-hmm. at the very least, I could say. Mm-hmm. And they had like a love of jazz music. They had like a love of quote unquote African dance, which, you know, mm-hmm. it wasn't accurate, who knows, but the way that Black culture was already present in the Soviet Union before these people even came. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. So I do think like some of that, I do hint at it. There is an episode where they go to the Red Square and there's a statue of Pushkin there. Mm-hmm. And Langston Hughes gives a little history lesson about Pushkin and his mm-hmm. ancestor, who, yes, was nice. Black. Mm-hmm. And so I do think there are so many nuggets about Soviet history and more digging deeper into the politics that are more hinted at or assumed. Mm-hmm. But I am happy that we focus on the personal and sort of let the political spur from that, because mm-hmm. it just was such a personal trip. And there were so many relationships and changes going on with Dorothy West. You know, she's growing up. I see this trip as her sort of maturing into adulthood and entering romantic relationships, romantic entanglements. So we focused more on that. But I think the politics of the time are just so interesting. The culture of the time and the Soviet Union is so interesting. And we go into that a little bit more on those like behind the scenes episodes. So I'm glad we at least got it in there.
Yeah. But
yes. I think that's what, if I had more time, I think there would have been a little bit more color as far as what the Soviet Union was like at that time.
Very. Yeah, I would love that. I mean, I thought the series launched this week, not last week. So I didn't get to hear it. Full disclosure. But I'm looking forward to listening to it. And I mean, yeah, I hear you. There's so much of the HR, the Harlem Renaissance and Harlem in the 1920s that I want to bring in so badly, but you know, you don't want to overwhelm the listener. You don't want to have too many characters. You don't want to have too many sounds.
Audio.
Yeah. Yes. And you have to keep the story straight, like forward moving. Like you don't want to pick up things that, you know, oh, I noticed this. Oh, and you got to keep it direct, I think, in my opinion. You can't just go off on tangents. So I love that. And I'm curious to know, are you interested in making more audio dramas?
Absolutely. I experienced a huge boom in audio dramas when I was in college. When I was in grad school, I entered during COVID. And so audio dramas have become the new frontier for playwrights, for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, Audible right now is killing the game and is even bringing them on stage. And so for me, like I said, it's a huge learning experience, and it mm-hmm. only makes me want to write another one because I'm like, I could do it even better next time. Yeah. So I definitely am thinking a lot about that, thinking about maybe producing my own like you are. I think the possibilities of audio are really endless. And I actually did, funnily enough, turn one of my other plays into an audio play because mm-hmm. of COVID, because we mm-hmm. couldn't really perform on stage in the traditional sense. And so I wrote it as an audio drama for my second year project. Mm-hmm. And I really loved it. And I'm still editing that piece. And I think there's something so intimate about
audio
that I'm like, I feel like I've just like scratched the surface with this story.
Oh, that's wonderful. We'd love to have you in our crew of audio drama creators. I think that, my humble opinion, if you are a writer or a storyteller, you really should look into audio dramas as an option to get your work, quote unquote, out there and work with actors. Like, I've learned so much, like, by writing and making Harlem Queen, about writing and structure. I mean, so much. I don't even want to go into it, but stakes, conflict, enter, out a scene, get in and get out. I mean, and working with actors are like wonderful because they teach me how to write better because of their annoying questions. Like, what's my, like, why is she standing in the rain? Oh, because I needed a rain sound effect, you know, but you need to say more than that,
you
know, but I love my actors. They're all so great. And Stephanie Gabrielle, who plays Stephanie Sinclair, asks the hardest questions, because she's Stephanie Sinclair. She needs to know. And I'm like, so now when I'm writing, I have to think about, okay, what is Gabby going to ask me about this? Why is, what's the, so that makes me a stronger writer for sure. So I strongly encourage it for writers. And it's such a wonderful way to get your stories to me out there. Like I was saying to someone else, like I could not fill a theater. I couldn't fill a theater of 100 people. Like, thousands of times over, you know what I mean? Like, I'm lucky if I get 50 people showing up for something, you know, which was our live show. And we had 50 people. I mean, we had a full house, right, which is thank you. I mean, that was tremendous. Shout out to the people who came. Can you talk to us a little bit about, and I know, oh my gosh, it's like, I don't want to take up too much of your time.
No,
we'll wrap up with working with the actors and how that has helped you, informed your writing?
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Something stuck in my throat. Well, as I mentioned, I wasn't there for all of the recording, so I can't speak to all of it, but I did have a main crew, and it was a very fast process that I would not recommend if you're, I mean, if you're self-producing, it's a little different, but they had a timeline that they wanted to stick to. Also, I was a student, and so I had a shortened timeline as well. It was technically an internship, so it had to be done, certain number of hours, certain number of weeks, yada, yada, yada. So it was very, very quick. We did like, I think, one Zoom reading, and then I had a week or two to edit. And even just that one reading, I don't even think I stayed for questions after. I think I just said thank you, bye, and and just did notes just based on hearing it out loud for the first time. Mm-hmm. It was so helpful. And like you said, actors are you know, irreplaceable. And like you, obviously you need them for the show, but they also teach you so much before they even perform it. And so after I did that one reading over Zoom, we had a little bit of back and forth, but honestly, not very much because it was just such a shortened timeline. And so I think we had two rehearsals in person, and that was also really great. I was really grateful that at least with the initial group of actors, they were all based in New York. And so we all got to come together, me, the director, the producer, and all the actors that were part of that first wave of recording. And that was great because the director like warmed them up, and like we got to talk a lot about the language and how important it was. Like you said, like the way they say certain words, even like the way they say their R's, the way they say their T's, like all of that made for like such crisp and amazing sounding line reads. But I mean, I would leave rehearsal every day and come back with new pages. I mean, it was so exhilarating as a writer because you sort of are faced, especially with audio. I mean, it's really your writing laid bare. Like you said, like, yeah, you can add audio and everything, but it really becomes clear where the plot holes are, what parts are confusing, why does this scene exist? Mm-hmm. Like if we're paying to do this scene, why does it, it needs to have a purpose.
Sure.
And so I had to really, I think that was one of the most important parts was literally writing like the header of the scene and writing, this is the thing that is happening.
Yes.
And cutting everything else that does not have to do with that thing that needs to happen in the scene to move the story forward. Mm-hmm. And then even recording the day of, people were still, I was always very open to, if this sounds funny in your mouth, there's another way you would say it. If it's coming out strangely, like give me some suggestions. I'm happy to change lines, even on the fly. And that definitely happened quite a few times. Mm-hmm. And it just made it more exciting, more invigorating to be like, oh my gosh, like it's the day of recording. And yes, we finally have that like punchline that wasn't working before. Like now, like this actor has given me a joke and I'm like, yep, put that in. That's incredible. Yeah. So I'm forever grateful for them. And the second wave of actors did great as well. I just wasn't as involved with that one. And it was really, because I wasn't as involved in post-production, it was really wild to, the next time I heard it, it was like fully realized with all the sound effects.
Right.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Like, sounds very different from just like us being in the booth and just like voices. So it was really, really fun, but wonderful. really tight turnaround.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I imagine it would be kind of stressful, fun, but stressful with such a tight turnaround. And I agree, like before I knew how to make an audio drama, I just did all this out of like step-by-step, bit-by-bit, going on what I already knew. And one thing I did not want to skimp on was a sound designer. I knew that you needed to have a great sound, someone who's going to do those, like an example I had, like my sound designer is terrific. And I had one previous and he was terrific. But like it's 1920, like I zhuzhed the timeline a little bit. So I'm like 1926, 29, maybe 1930. So I don't want, when I have a bus, I don't want bus, an M5. I live in Harlem. Like,
okay, and then,
right. So I just said, okay, forget the bus. Put cobblestones and a horse. Because there are still cobblestones down. I live in Harlem, down the street from me. If there were horses, who cares? I don't know. But I judged it a little bit. A sound design.
Yes.
And it's wonderful because you can be anywhere. You can be. Now I know why so many people make like sci-fi audio dramas, because you can be out in space.
Fantasy. Yeah.
Exactly. And historical fiction makes sense because I could not make a film.
Yeah, it would have been so expensive. Place.
Yes, exactly. Or short, or commercial, or anything.
All the time. I mean, in the theater, I'm like, even getting all of these people in period accurate costumes.
Yes.
So expensive.
Oh my gosh. There's no, and I just encourage writers, because it's not cheap, but it's affordable, I think. And when I say affordable, if I can do it, I shouldn't say that. Anyone could, but it's, it is affordable. You can do it.
You can scale down, you know, it could literally just be you in your bedroom and you are the sound designer. You are the producer, and you could have a team. Like, I'm really grateful that I had a huge team behind me, and that I didn't really, you know, I can't take credit for the team that the Griot put together on that end. So I'm really grateful that they took that off my hands. But I have friends who have approached me now who are like, oh, I would love to just like record a short story. Can you write something?
Yeah.
And I'll audio do it. You do the writing. And I'm like, that's awesome. Like, two person team. And we got a new audio play. So it's
exactly.
Awesome.
That's wonderful. Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you again to Ali Mims for their time to chat. Check out Harlem to Moscow wherever you get your podcasts.
The Fable and Folly Network, where fiction producers flourish.
Hi, folks. Let me see if I can sum up Midnight Burger in about 25 seconds.
Really big monster.
Zero irony.
Pardon me, Gloria. Might my husband and I have a word?
The radio is talking to me.
So this is how it ends. Eaten by wolves in space.
There's a pocket dimension in the deep freeze.
This is the stupidest dystopia we've ever been to.
What the hell is that?
Because you're having a cigarette in 415 million BC.
Where are we?
Space.
Can you narrow that down?
The bad part?
Ava.
Yeah, that didn't work at all. At the nexus of all things, there is a diner. Look for Midnight Burger on your favorite podcasting app, or just go to weopenat6.com.